Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Dr. Kim Mulvihill, the CBS 5 Health Watch Doctor, and I'll be your moderator for today. This program is being held in association with the Commonwealth Club's Health and Medicine Forum. And now it's my great pleasure to introduce our very special guest, Dr. Dean Ornish. Here's a guy who grew up in Texas. Now, these Texans, according to Frommers, are famous for their love of artery-clogging steaks the size of Volkswagens. Not to mention the Frito pie. For those who don't know, that's meaty chili, cheese, and diced onions poured over a plate of Frito corn chips. Dr. Ornish completed his medical training at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston, where he probably had a slice or two of that Boston cream pie. He's grinning. Not to mention a few flutternutters. He looks surprised by that one. Flutternutters, in case you don't know, that happens to be the proposed official sandwich in Massachusetts, a sandwich made with peanut butter and marshmallow cream. But lucky for us, Dean saw the light and headed west, not just to California, but to the San Francisco Bay Area, land of the fruits and nuts. Seriously, Dr. Ornish is the founder and president of the Preventive Medicine Research Institute in Sausalito, California. This nonprofit performs scientific research that investigates the effects of diet and lifestyle choices on health and disease. His group demonstrated for the first time that comprehensive lifestyle changes may begin to reverse even severe coronary artery disease without drugs or surgery. What could be better than that? He's the author of 6 best-selling books, including 4 New York Times bestsellers. But get this. He's been recognized as one of the most interesting people of 1996 by People magazine, chosen by Life magazine as one of the 50 most influential members of his generation, by Forbes magazine as one of the 7 most powerful teachers in the world. And tonight, we are fortunate to have him on our menu. Welcome, Dean, to the Commonwealth Club.
Well, thank you, Kim, for that kind introduction and to all of you for coming tonight. I appreciate the chance to share with you what my colleagues and I have been doing for more than 3 decades now, and also to Adria for your kind introduction as well. It is true I'm from Texas, and where I don't know if I can say this on the radio, where shit is a 3-syllable word, but that's a whole other thing. But what you didn't, I know the patient you're talking about, and what you didn't say is that his doctor didn't want him to be in the study because he was so sick he didn't think he'd make it through the year, but I saw him last week and he said that his doctor has since died, so he's still there. I also want to say that I almost didn't make it here tonight. You know, I thought that GPS was one of the great inventions of the 20th century because I have many good qualities, but a sense of direction is pretty far down on the list. And my GPS was kind of like, you know, Hal the computer at the end of the movie when he starts to sing, you know, "Dave, I'm sorry, I can't do that. I'm going to the GPS. You've got to get me there. I'm late." And it's like, "I'm sorry, Dean, I can't do that." And it sent me, like, to the most ridiculous places. I was coming up from Palo Alto, which I don't know that all that well, even though I've lived in the Bay Area for so many years. So at 6:01, I finally got here, and so I'm glad to be here with everybody. I thought this will give me a chance to practice what I preach a little bit. What I want to talk about today is the power of simple changes in diet and lifestyle. You know, we tend to think of advances in medicine as being a new drug or a new laser or something really high-tech and expensive. And we often have a hard time believing that these simple choices that we make in our lives each day, like what we eat and how we respond to stress and how much exercise we get and whether or not we smoke, and perhaps most important, the quality of our loving relationships, we often have a hard time believing that these simple choices can make such a powerful difference in our lives, but they often do. And in our work, we've been able to use very high-tech, expensive, state-of-the-art medical technology like quantitative arteriography and cardiac PET scans and radionuclide matriculography and heart disease or MR spectroscopy in prostate cancer and gene expression to prove the power of these very simple and low-tech and often ancient interventions. And so I want to share with you some of that. But before I get into the research, I thought it might be useful to just show a slide I've been showing for literally decades now, but it's still as true now as it was then, which is that this is a slide of doctors busily mopping up the floor around a sink that's overflowing without also turning off the faucet. And it's a simple idea, but it's a powerful one. It's radical. Even the word radical, you know, sometimes doctors, you know, not so much anymore, but they say, why are you doing this radical intervention? Why aren't you doing something more conservative, like, you know, cutting people's chests open, as opposed to this radical intervention of eating vegetables and walking and meditating? But radical really means to get to the root. A square root sign used to be called a radical for that reason. And that is radical in the sense that we are trying to get to the root of what causes not only illness, but suffering in general. And I'll talk more about that later. And the idea is sometimes you do need to mop up the floor. Sometimes we do need drugs and surgery. This is not alternative. This is integrative. But if that's all we do, you know, what are you told when you, if you have high cholesterol and you go to your doctor, or high blood pressure or diabetes, take this pill. And you say, okay, well, how long do I have to take it? Forever. Well, why do I have to take it forever? It's like, here's your mops and brooms, mop up the floor. How long do I have to keep mopping it up? Forever, because the sink keeps overflowing. Well, why not just turn off the faucet? Why not deal with the cause of the problem? And when we do, we find that our bodies have a remarkable capacity to begin healing themselves, and much more quickly than we had once realized, if we really treat the cause. And if we don't, the same problem comes back again more often than not. The bypasses reocclude, the angioplasties restenose. It's also true on a health policy level. If we don't treat the underlying causes of why people get sick, if we just, say, take 43 million more Americans and start covering them, which we need to do, but if we don't change what we do, if we just provide the coverage but not what we cover, just who we cover, then we just do that many more bypasses and angioplasties and radical prostatectomies and so on, and so our costs go up exponentially. Then we have these painful choices. Do we ration? Do we raise taxes? Do we let the deficit go up? None of them are very good. And so what we find is that on a personal level, as well as on a social level, if we can treat the cause, then we have new hope and new choices and new opportunities where we can make true health care available to those who most need it. And have, rather than have costs go up, they go down. But before we get into that, I thought it might be worth talking about what the program is, that it's what we eat, how we respond to stress, how much exercise and fitness we have, and how much we call it psychosocial support, but it's really love and intimacy. Now, before I get into the research, I thought it may be worth talking about what is it that enables people to make sustainable changes. Because when I first started doing this work, it was like, oh, nobody could do this, and even if they did, it wouldn't matter. And it was like, well, you know, your patients did it, but nobody else can do it. And then, so over a period of time, what we began to show is that this is sustainable, that it's not all or nothing. If you're trying to reverse a chronic disease like heart disease or diabetes or prostate cancer, that's more the pound of cure. But if you're just trying to stay healthy or lose a few pounds or get your cholesterol or blood pressure or diabetes under control, you have a spectrum of choices. And the more you change, the more you improve and the better you feel. And this is a theme I want to come back to. But the better you feel is really what's sustainable, because what's sustainable is not fear of dying, it's joy of living. And it's joy and freedom and pleasure. Because when I was trained, I was taught to try to scare people into changing. You know, the whole idea of risk factor reduction is based on fear. You know, if you don't quit smoking, you're going to get lung cancer. If you don't change your diet, you're going to get a heart attack. But the problem is, if you go on a diet, sooner or later you're going to go off a diet, because what's sustainable is freedom and pleasure and joy. And as soon as somebody says, eat this and don't eat that and do this and don't do that, people just want to do the opposite. I've just learned that the hard way. I mean, it goes back to the first dietary intervention when God said, don't eat the apple, and that didn't work, and that was God talking, so we're not going to do better than that. And so some of the lessons that I learned are that if you talk about risk factor reduction, it's just boring for most people. They say things like, I don't care if I live longer, I just want to enjoy my life, I want to have fun. And that fear of dying is really not a sustainable motivator. Fear in general is not a sustainable motivator, because it's one of the reasons why people say, you know, many doctors say, it's like that, remember that scene in Indiana Jones when the guy comes out and does his, you know, his sword play, and then Indiana Jones kind of just takes out a gun and shoots him. It's like, why screw around all this touchy-feely stuff when you just take a pill, right? I mean, you can take some Lipitor and that'll do it. And taking a pill is easy and everybody will do that, but changing lifestyle is difficult if not impossible. And yet if you really take an evidence-based approach, the data show quite the opposite, that 2/3 of the people who are prescribed Lipitor or Pravacol or Crestor or any of the cholesterol-lowering drugs, or for that matter, blood pressure pills, or for about most medications, are not taking them just 3 months later. Two-thirds of the people are not taking them just 3 months later. And you might say, well, why is that? If they usually someone else is paying for it, and usually the side effects aren't so great for most people, so why aren't you doing that? And the answer is because they're fear-based. You're taking a pill today to prevent something really bad like a heart attack or a stroke years down the road that you don't want to think about, so you don't. Now, if you've had a heart attack or a stroke, you'll do pretty much anything your doctor or nurse or health professional says for maybe, I don't know, a month or two, and then the denial comes back because, you know, I don't want to be the first to break the news to you, but the mortality rate is still 100%. It's one per person. You know, we're all going to die, but it's not something we think about most of the time because it's too scary. And so fear-based approaches are not sustainable, even if it's something as simple as taking a pill. But the paradox is when you change your diet and lifestyle, most people find they feel so much better so quickly, it reframes the reason for making the changes from fear of dying to joy of living. And remember, it's joy and pleasure and freedom that are sustainable. The cartoon says, I give smokers a discount because there's not as much to tell, the fortune teller. That's the fear-based approach. What does work, though, is joy and pleasure, because there's no point in giving up something that you enjoy unless you get something back that's better and quickly. And when people make these changes, because we're learning that these mechanisms that control our sense of health and well-being are way more dynamic than most people had realized. Now, when people say, oh, I can't change my lifestyle, this is my my family, my wife, Ann, and son, Lucas, and baby Jasmine, baby Jazz. How many of you have at least one child? I'm just curious. Raise your hands. Was that a big change in your lifestyle when you had your first kid? Mm-hmm. Was it harder than you thought? Mm-hmm. A lot harder? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I see you go, yeah. How many of you have more than one child? Did you forget? Or were you just careless? I mean, that's the point is, you know, it's the hardest thing I've ever done, and it's by far the most wonderful thing I've ever done. And that's the point is that people are not afraid to make big choices in their life, big changes in their life, if they understand that it's worth it. And part of the value of science is to help connect the dots between what we do and how we feel. And suddenly you begin to realize, oh, when I do this, I feel good. When I do that, I don't feel so good. So maybe I'll do more of this and less of that. And it comes out of your own experience, not because some doctor or some book told you, because you can really see that. And awareness is always the first step in healing. It turns out that people who overall eat the healthiest, studies show, allow themselves some indulgences because, again, life is to be enjoyed, and it's not sustainable if you feel like you're depriving yourself all the time. So, and there are a lot of false choices that we have. You know, people say, is it fun for me or is it good for me? I remember I was consulting with a big food company to try to get them to make healthier foods, and they said, these are our fun-for-you foods and these are our good-for-you foods. And I said, well, that's the problem. Why isn't it fun for you to look good and feel good and have more energy and better sex and, you know, have your pains go away? And, you know, the old joke is, you know, am I going to live longer? Is it just going to seem longer if I eat and live more healthily? And that isn't a choice because you can have both. And I just want to share with you some of the data that talk about that. Even the language that we use, behavioral change doctors like to talk about, you know, these are good foods and these are bad foods. And as soon as you call foods good or bad, it's a small step to thinking of yourself, I'm a bad person because I eat bad food. And at that point, you might as well just finish the cheeseburger, you know, because you're already a bad person. I mean, I can't go out to dinner without someone either apologizing for what they're eating or commenting on what I'm eating. I'm saying, you know, you are forgiven. You know, I'm not the food police. You know, I don't care what you eat. That's really your business. But still, there's that whole moralistic quality to it. I'm sure that happens with you too, Kim, right? And there's this fascist quality of patient compliance. It's such a creepy word. You know, it's about manipulating behavior and forcing change. And even willpower has that same kind of, I'm forcing myself to change. And again, that's not sustainable because what's sustainable is feeling free. And you're not feeling free if you feel like someone else or you're even forcing yourself to change. But there's a spectrum of choices, and I'll come back to that. And so if you indulge yourself one day, it doesn't mean you failed or you're bad or you're whatever. Just eat healthier the next. If you don't exercise one day, do a little more the next. If you don't have time to meditate for an hour, do a minute. You know, sometimes I get really busy like we all do. I don't have an hour to meditate every day. So I'll say, well, do I have a minute? And if I have to admit to myself that I don't have a minute, then I have to admit that my life is so out of balance, I'd rather just do the minute, you know. And then if I do the minute, chances are I'm going to do more than that anyway. But even a minute has value. It's like if you hear a song on the radio and you find yourself humming it later in the day because subconsciously your mind keeps doing that. And so these are simple things. Awareness is really the first step in healing. Part of the value of science is it can increase the level of awareness so we understand how powerful these simple choices are. It doesn't have to be something really high-tech to be powerful. And I want to give you some examples of that, because we've shown in that the same simple lifestyle program can not only prevent but often reverse even chronic diseases like heart disease and early-stage prostate cancer and diabetes and so on. And so these things were thought impossible just a few years ago, and now they've become fairly routine. And so to me, science is great because it's important, but not everything that's, as Albert Einstein once said, not everything that counts can be counted, not everything that's meaningful is measurable, but a lot of things are. And I want to share with you how dynamic these mechanisms are so you can get a sense of that. So when you eat healthier, when you manage stress, when you exercise, when you love more, your brain gets more blood and more oxygen, you think more clearly, you have more energy, you need less sleep. We've all experienced the opposite. How do you feel an hour or two after you've had like a Thanksgiving feast and pig out? How do you feel an hour or two later? Sleepy, right? Because your brain is literally getting less blood and less oxygen. But the opposite is also true. When you eat and live more healthily, your brain gets more oxygen, more blood flow. You think more clearly. You just feel better. What's even more interesting is that you can actually grow so many new brain neurons, your brain can actually get measurably bigger in just a few months. This is a field called neuroplasticity. Now, when I was in medical school, I was taught, you know, you're born with a certain amount of brain cells, and if you go out and have a six-pack or you binge on a weekend, you lose a few hundred thousand cells, you never get them back. The good news is that you do, and that even our brains are much more dynamic than we had once realized. And some of my favorite substances actually promote neurogenesis, cause your brain to grow new blood cells. Chocolate, for example, and tea and blueberries make your brain smarter, they grow more brain cells, whereas things that are bad for your heart are also bad for your brain. So saturated fat and sugar and nicotine not only are bad for your heart, they actually cause you to diminish the number of brain cells you have. Moderate alcohol increases neurogenesis, whereas excessive alcohol kills your brain cells. Stress management increases it. Chronic stress decreases it. Moderate exercise, just walking 20 or 30 minutes a day, I'll show you in a study in a moment, causes your brain to grow new cells, but being a couch potato doesn't. And believe it or not, even cannabinoids in marijuana increase neurogenesis, whereas cocaine and amphetamines and stimulants cause them to decrease it. What were we just talking about? Never mind. Sorry. And so it's important to point out that what we include in our diet is as important as what we exclude, because there are literally hundreds of thousands of protective substances that you find in predominantly in fruits and vegetables and whole grains and legumes and soy products and a little fish that are protective, that, you know, phytochemicals, bioflavonoids, carotenoids, retinols, isoflavones, genistein, lycopene, on and on, that have helped to prevent heart disease, cancer, and slow the aging process. And so it's not just what you exclude, it's also what you include. And then you can have more of a sense of abundance rather than deprivation. Now, one study in two of the most prestigious scientific journals, Nature Neurosciences and the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, found that just walking for a half hour a day or 3 hours a week, and not even all that fast or even all at once, caused so many new brain cells to grow that people's brains got bigger. And these were older people. So these changes occur as much at an older age as they do at a younger age, which is, I think, also very empowering. Tango, this is when my wife and I found out we were pregnant with baby Jazz. We went to Buenos Aires with our tango teachers. It turns out tango causes your brain to grow new brain cells, which is great. And chronic stress not only decreases neurogenesis, but particularly in areas where you don't want that to happen, like in your hippocampus that controls memory, which is why when you're under chronic stress, you may become more forgetful. Your skin gets more blood when you are eating and living more healthily. Christy Turlington is the supermodel. Her father died of lung cancer. She has a wonderful website called smokingisugly.com because, you know, smoking is supposed to make you so beautiful and sexy. And what smoking does is the nicotine in smoke causes your arteries to constrict, which is why it can cause a heart attack. If your arteries in your heart constrict or in your brain, it can cause a stroke. But in your skin, the little tiny arterioles constrict, and it causes you to wrinkle faster and have that kind of gray pallor. It makes you look 10 or 20 years older. So smoking, rather than making you beautiful, actually makes you ugly. And one of the most effective anti-smoking ads was done by the Department of Health Services here in California, because smoking is the anti-Viagra. Half of guys who smoke are impotent. Like, how sexy is that? And I love this ad that it shows the Marlboro Man with a lip cigarette hanging out of his mouth.
Yeah.
You notice that the caption doesn't say heart attack or emphysema. It says impotence. So instead of making you ugly and, I mean, it's making you beautiful and sexy, it makes you ugly and impotent. That puts it into the here and now. Remember, fear is not a good motivator, but if you can help people connect the dots between what they do and how they feel, then that's very powerful. If you just say, oh, smoking is dangerous, that just makes it cool. You know, it's like riding a Harley, you know, or a BMW motorcycle. It's like cool because it's dangerous. But if you say it makes you ugly and impotent, how cool is that? That's not very cool. So it's important that we bring things into present tense. Your heart gets more blood when you make these changes. You can reverse heart disease. And we're able to show that even severely blocked arteries, like in the upper left, a year later in the upper right where the arrow is, can become wider and you get more blood. And because the blood flow is a fourth power function of the diameter, even relatively small changes in the blockages can cause big improvements in blood flow. In this case, there was a 300% improvement in blood flow. This was in the lower left is a PET scan. The blue and black area is a large part of the heart that's not receiving any blood flow. And then a year later, it's the orange and white is maximal blood flow. You can see it's almost normal. Clinically, this is a guy who literally couldn't walk across the street without getting severe chest pain, like the guy that you ran into in the Rainbow Market. It took him an hour to take a shower because he had so much pain. He couldn't have sex. He was riding a wheelchair around Walmart. And then within a month, he was essentially pain-free. And by the end of the year, he went backpacking in the Swiss Alps at 10,000 feet with a 35-pound backpack and no pain at all. And that's not unusual. And many doctors have a hard time believing that people can actually improve so much by simply changing their lifestyle, but they usually do. And that's what makes it sustainable. We have people who are still meeting at our nonprofit Preventive Medicine Research Institute 27 years after the study ended just because the community that we formed was so powerful that they wanted to keep meeting. And I'll talk more about that in a moment. When we looked at all the arteries and all the lesions, we found that the amount of blockage was the same at the beginning, but the randomized comparison group showed some worsening of their blockages after 1 year and even more progression of their disease after 5 years. That's the so-called natural history of heart disease, but there's nothing natural about it. It's that instead of getting worse and worse, we found in the green line that there was some reversal of the arterial blockages after 1 year and even more after 5 years. What I found particularly interesting was that the primary determinant of improvement wasn't how old people were and it wasn't how sick they were. The more they changed their diet and lifestyle, the better they felt and the more they improved in ways we could measure. We found that in our heart disease studies, in our cancer studies, even in our gene studies. The person who was 96 years old showed the most reversal, but he also made the most change in his lifestyle. Whereas the risks of surgery increase as you get older, the benefits of lifestyle changes don't seem to be age-related. That's a very powerful message to be able to give people. I got this as a Christmas card a few years ago from two of the patients in one of the hospitals we trained in New York. The younger brother on the left is 78, and the one on the right is 83, the Weintraub brothers. And the following year, they wanted to show me how much more flexible they were after doing their yoga. And the following year, they sent me this one, which I thought was pretty funny. So you just never know how much better people can get. Unretouched photo. We found a 40% reduction in their LDL cholesterol levels, comparable to what you can get with drugs like Lipitor. Now, we spent $20 billion on Lipitor, this one drug, last year. But you can accomplish the same thing simply by changing lifestyle at a fraction of the cost, and the only side effects are good ones. I mean, what's the more radical intervention? We also found that we may be able to slow or stop or even reverse the progression of early-stage prostate cancer. We did the study in collaboration with Dr. Peter Carroll, who's the chair of urology here at UCSF, and the late Dr. Bill Fair, who at the time was the chair of urology at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And we took men who had biopsy-proven prostate cancer, who had elected for reasons unrelated to our study not to be treated conventionally, so that we could then randomly divide them into two groups and see what the effects of lifestyle changes alone were without being confounded with, you know, chemo and radiation and surgery. And what we found is that their PSA levels went up or got worse in the comparison group, but went down or got better in the experimental group who made these changes, and those differences were highly significant. We also found that there was that same dose-response effect. The more people changed their lifestyle across both groups, the lower their PSA levels went. We wondered, well, maybe we're just affecting PSA. It's an imperfect measure of prostate cancer. And so we sent some of their blood serum down to Dr. Bill Aronson's lab at UCLA, and they added it to a standard line of prostate tumor cells growing in tissue culture, and found that the tumor growth was inhibited 70% in the group that made these changes, but only 9% in the comparison group. And I thought one of the coolest slides was we found that the more people changed their lifestyle, the more it directly inhibited the growth of their prostate tumors. That's a pretty exciting finding. And then we also did MRI and MR spectroscopy on a subset of patients, and we found that the tumor activity, which is shown in red, began to diminish or shrink, as well as the PSA coming down. So taken as a whole, we're pretty confident that we're actually able to affect the progression of prostate cancer. Now, in contrast, the studies in the New England Journal of Medicine the last year or two showed that only 1 out of 50 men who gets a radical prostatectomy actually lives longer. And yet most men who get these procedures have either impotence or incontinence or both, whether it's a surgery or chemo or brachytherapy or 3D conformal radiation. And so before we put men through something that's going to so dramatically compromise the quality of their lives, I think it's incumbent on us to first prove that it really works. And even if you need surgery, you'd be wise to make these lifestyle changes, because even if they think they got it all, there are microscopic metastases, and the lifestyle changes may help to prevent the recurrence, even if you have these procedures. So we wondered, well, how is it that people can get better so quickly? And so we thought, let's take a look at their genes. And so what we found was that the gene expression in these patients, over 500 genes were changed in just 3 months. And in every case where we could mark what the gene did, it was turning on the good genes that prevent disease and turning off the bad genes that promote disease. Particularly the oncogenes, what are called the RAS oncogenes that promote breast and prostate cancer, were downregulated or turned off. There's an emerging field of science called epigenetics, which is looking at the effects of lifestyle and environment on gene expression. And what's interesting is that it not only changes your genes, but you can transmit those improved genes to your kids. And so in some ways, Lamarck was right, that it's this debate of nature versus nurture. It's both, and they both can go in both directions, and for better and for worse. And that's an exciting finding. We published that in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, and Craig Venter was the communicating editor. These are the RAS oncogenes here. Red is turned on. I don't know why geneticists do things backwards than you would think, but and green is turned off. And you can see on the left are the genes that promote breast and prostate cancer that are turned on mostly, and you can see just 3 months later how most of them are turned off. I think that's really exciting, because so often people say things, and Kim, I'm sure people say this to you, you know, I've just got bad genes, what can I do? What I call genetic nihilism. And I say, you know what, you can do a lot. And just knowing that can be very inspiring for people and empowering to them, because we're not victims of bad genes or bad luck or bad fate. Not to blame people, but to empower them. If we're just a victim of bad genes, what can you do? You're just helpless. I don't like that feeling. But we're not. To be empowered means you can do something about it. It doesn't mean that you can always guarantee that you're going to get better, but in most cases, to the degree you make these changes, there's a corresponding degree of improvement. Meditation alone, it turns out, can change gene expression. This was a study done by Jeff Dusick at Harvard, where they looked at meditation. They had a control group of non-meditators, people they taught to meditate for 8 weeks, and advanced meditators. And you can see it gets progressively more green, looking at the heat map of the genes, as you go from no meditation to some meditation to a lot of meditation, and likewise it goes more red for the upregulated genes. Now, so often people say, you know, diet I get, I got to eat something, so let me eat something healthy, and I got to exercise, you know, you're really doing something, you're out there just, you know, it has that kind of macho quality to it. But meditation still often has that wimp factor, you know, like, oh, I'm just kind of sitting, not doing anything. And yet meditation is incredibly powerful. Because meditation is, among other things, the practice of focusing your awareness onto one thing. And anytime you can focus energy, you gain power. You know, a magnifying glass is just the sun's rays focus. You can burn through paper. A laser is just coherent light. You can burn through steel or bounce it off the moon. And mental energy is no different. Now, unfortunately, the times that most people are most focused is when they're scared or angry. And then you're focused, but in a negative way, and then it has a negative effect on your body. But it also works in a positive way as well. We did a study with Dr. Elizabeth Blackburn, who was awarded the Nobel Prize a year ago for her discovery of telomerase. And telomerase is an enzyme that repairs and lengthens damaged telomeres, which are the ends of our chromosomes that control aging. So as your telomeres get shorter, your life gets shorter. And she published a landmark paper with Dr. Alyssa Eppel, who's also at UCSF, where they looked at women who were chronic caregivers and under chronic stress because they were taking care of parents with Alzheimer's. And they found that the more stress the women reported feeling and the longer they reported feeling stress, the lower their telomerase and the shorter were their telomeres. This was one of the first studies showing that chronic emotional stress may actually shorten your lifespan. And so it was really a powerful thing for a lot of people to see. So we were presenting at a conference together with the Dalai Lama, of all things, And I said, you know, most things I got excited when I saw this paper. I said, you know, most things in biology go both directions. If bad things make your telomeres shorter, maybe good things will make them longer. And she said, well, no one's ever shown that before, and that's always music to my ears. I said, well, let's find out. And so we did a study, and in the same group of men, we found that not only did it change their gene expression, it changed their telomerase, and thus likely their telomere length. We found that the telomerase increased by almost 30% in only 3 months. What's interesting is that nothing has been shown so far other than this to increase telomerase, including drugs. I mean, if drug X did this, it'd be a $1 billion drug, and yet it's just the lifestyle changes. It's sometimes hard to believe for people that these simple choices can make such a powerful difference in their lifestyle, but it clearly does. So our genes are a predisposition, but our genes are not our fate, and I think that's a very powerful message to be able to give people. So in many ways, lifestyle changes can not only be as good as drugs, but in some cases even better. I gave a talk at the Institute of Medicine last year at their Summit on Integrated Medicine and was making this point that, for example, a major study in the New England Journal of Medicine 8 years ago compared a drug to treat diabetes, a lifestyle to treat diabetes, and nothing. And they found that the lifestyle worked even better than the drug at preventing diabetes. A more recent study found that they said, well, what if we give two drugs to treat diabetes? Can we reduce the complications of the eye, nerve, and kidney damage that you find with diabetes and heart disease? And what they found was that the drugs actually made it worse. And so the editorial said, you know, we should steer away from using these two drugs and use effective lifestyle interventions, and only in selected individuals use the drugs to increase, because we have an epidemic of diabetes. So the lifestyle works even better than drugs. And we found that, and I'll show you some data in a moment, that most people can reduce their blood sugar simply by changing lifestyle to the point where under their doctor's supervision they can get off these diabetes drugs. And your body can then prevent the eye, nerve, kidney damage, heart disease, and other complications of diabetes. That's a powerful thing to know. Lifestyle changes can be synergistic with drugs. Sometimes lifestyle plus drugs work better than either alone. So again, it's not alternative. It's often integrated. We can use both. My friend John Kabat-Zinn, who really popularized mindfulness meditation, did a study with meditation plus a drug to treat psoriasis or just the drug alone, and he found that the psoriasis cleared up much faster when people did both than when they just did one. And other studies have shown that when you give flu vaccines to meditators, they develop higher antibody titers than those who don't meditate. So here again, the synergy can often be better than either alone. And we also, speaking of mindfulness, we also teach people to eat more mindfully, that how we eat is as important as what we eat. I'm as guilty as the next person. I'll eat while I'm multitasking, while I'm watching TV or talking with a friend or at a movie. Have you ever been in a movie and you're eating a bag of popcorn and you're so engrossed in the movie, you kind of eat and you kind of look down and the bag of popcorn's empty? It's like, who ate this? Has that ever happened to you? Mm-hmm. It's happened to me. And so you got all the calories and none of the real pleasure, or not much of the pleasure. So that's eating mindlessly. But if we really eat mindfully, we don't have to make these false choices. You know, we can, instead of saying, let's do portion control, which always sounds so restrictive, and again, that's not sustainable. Let's have eating with ecstasy. My wife, Anne, has a DVD that's at the back of the Spectrum book, and it's also on our website. If you go to ornishspectrum.com or pmri.org, there's downloadable meditations you can get for free, one of which is called Eating with Ecstasy, which is great. And it's how you can meditate on a piece of chocolate. I love dark chocolate. So instead of getting some really, you know, low-fat, cheap, not-so-tasty chocolate, I try to get, like, really high-fat, you know, gourmet, Coco Bella kind of chocolate and meditate on it. I can spend 5 minutes on a single piece of dark chocolate, just like you might spend 5 minutes on a fine wine. You know, you don't just gulp it down if it's a nice, really expensive wine. You invoke all your five senses. You smell it. You look at the color. You look at the label. Where did it come from? You make a meditation on the wine. It's the same with anything, whether it's food or sex or music or art or massage or anything that's sensual. When you eat, do it mindfully, you get more pleasure, and you have, in the case of chocolate, fewer calories. And so that's a whole lot more sustainable than portion control, because it's all based on, remember, what's sustainable is joy and pleasure and freedom. And what, as I meant, and I said before, what you included is in your diet as important as what you exclude. And if you don't remember anything else we talk about today, I would encourage you to take at least 3 or 4 grams a day of the omega-3 fatty acids that you find in fish oil. If you're a strict vegan, you can get them in plankton-based fish oils, or not fish oils, but omega-3s. Because the omega-3s can reduce your incidence of sudden cardiac death by up to 80%. It can reduce your incidence of prostate and breast cancer. It can reduce chronic inflammation because of the, in most people, the ratio of omega-6 to omega-3 fatty acids is way out of balance, and so it promotes inflammation, which is a chronic underlying cause of so many conditions. And if you're a pregnant woman or you're breastfeeding, and you take them yourself, they end up in your breast milk, or you give them to your kids, it can actually raise your child's IQ by up to 7 points or 10 points in some studies, and reduce the incidence of hyperactivity and ADD. And so, again, what you include is as important as what you exclude. Now, it's not that there's one diet and lifestyle program for heart disease and another one for breast and prostate cancer and another one for changing your genes and another one for your telomeres and so on. It's the same program. It's just a question of degree. And so it makes it much easier because, again, what's good for your body is good in all the ways that we can measure it. It's not something that's just you don't have to do all kinds of different diet and lifestyle programs. And I thought it's worth talking a little bit about the health policy implication because, you know, our food choices profoundly affect three different areas that are in crisis right now. There's the health crisis, which we talked a little bit about, the global warming crisis, and the energy crisis. And they all intersect around what we eat and how we live. And it's so easy to get overwhelmed by saying, oh, gosh, you know, this is just too hard. I can't deal with all this stuff. What can I do as one person? But every day, what you put in your mouth, for example, makes a difference in all three of these areas. And let me just tell you why. Because what's personally sustainable is also what globally sustainable. What's good for you is good for the planet. Many people are surprised to learn that 3/4 of the $2.5 trillion in healthcare costs, what Senator Harkin probably more accurately refers to as sick care costs, are due to chronic diseases, most of which can be prevented or even reversed simply by making lifestyle changes. One study that was in the Archives of Internal Medicine last year looked at 23,000 different people, and they found that just moderate changes, walking a half hour a day, you know, sometimes I get angry when I can't find a parking place near the gym, which I think is like totally stupid. You know? So if I remind myself I can incorporate these things into my daily life, I don't even have to go to the gym if I don't want to, just take the stairs or park a little farther away, you know, simple things. It turns out it's just half hour of walking a day, not even all that fast or all at once, can make a difference. Not smoking, eating a healthy diet, and keeping a healthy weight prevented 93% of diabetes. I mean, imagine a drug that came out that could prevent 93% of diabetes, which is epidemic now. You know, again, everybody be taking it. Most heart attacks, most strokes, and even 36% of all cancers. And in certain cancers, like prostate and breast cancer, that number is much higher. I applaud what the First Lady Michelle Obama is doing by making childhood obesity a focal issue, because this is something that just transcends ideology. It doesn't matter if you're a red state or a blue state. If you think that somebody's hurting your kid, it brings out a real primal response. I'm sure all of you who have kids would say, yeah, I'd jump in front of a train for my kid if I thought it would save their life. And yet, when you hear that childhood obesity is so prevalent, that this may be the first generation in which our kids live a shorter lifespan than their parents, you know, that makes us want to really do something about it. And there's a lot we can do. It turns out that 2/3 of adults and over 15% of kids are overweight or obese. It's what the former Surgeon General, Richard Carmona, called the terrorist threat from within. But it doesn't have to be that way. But diabetes in 30-year-olds, for example, has risen 70% in the last 10 years. Our genes haven't changed that much. It's our lifestyle that's changed. And it's happening overseas now. Other countries are starting to eat like us and live like us and die like us, and I'll come back to that. And a recent study showed that teenagers who are overweight have the arteries of people who are 35 years older than them. So it's not just your chronological age, it's our biological age that really determines our quality of life. And it's reaching a tipping point with employers. This used to be relegated to the health resources, you know, human resources divisions in most companies. Now it's going to the CEO level because it's affecting the bottom line. At Starbucks, the CEO, Howard Schultz, said that we spend more money on healthcare than we do for coffee beans. Mars Candy spends more for healthcare than they do for sugar. General Motors spends more for healthcare than for steel. That's not sustainable. At Safeway 5 years ago, Steve Bird, the CEO, and I consulted, and he said, at that point, we're spending 120% of our net revenues on healthcare for our employees. That's not sustainable. And so we talked about putting at the work site many of these same principles, and in the first year, their costs came down 11% and have remained essentially flat since then, and he's become a real leader in this area as other people are starting to emulate that. Now, I want to talk about heart and blood vessel diseases, not only because they're so important, but as an example of these bigger issues. Heart and blood vessel diseases still kill more Americans than virtually everything else combined. And not only in this country, but now in almost every country in the world. Now, what's amazing is that it's almost completely preventable. You know, in a major study that was in The Lancet that Salim Youssef and others did in looking at people in all seven continents, they found that 95% of heart disease today is preventable simply by changing lifestyle. And that's probably an underestimation. So think about it. We have heart disease and blood vessel diseases kill more people than everything else combined around the world, and it's almost completely preventable, right? That's crazy. Now, how do we treat heart disease? Well, we treat it with angioplasties and bypass surgery. Now, and we spent a lot of money on that. We spent $60 billion on angioplasties and stents last year and $40 billion on bypass surgery. I mean, that's $100 billion just in this country. Now, you might say, well, maybe that's worth it if we save all these lives, except that's not what the data show. We really practice evidence-based medicine. What do the data show? Well, there was a major study that was, again, in the New England Journal of Medicine. We're not talking about fringe journals here, that spent almost $40 million, a randomized controlled trial, comparing people with heart disease who got a stent and an angioplasty versus those who didn't. And they found that they didn't live longer, and they didn't even prevent heart attacks. And in the short run, they might have actually increased the risk. So you would think if we were really practicing evidence-based medicine, that the number of angioplasties would have gone way, way down. The one group that it may prolong life is if you're actually in the middle of having a heart attack, and angioplasty and TPA and things like that may actually prevent, may have benefit. But that's a fraction, maybe 2% of people who get angioplasties and stents. For the other 98%, you'd say if we're really practicing evidence-based medicine, the number of angioplasties should have gone way, way down. But the data actually show they're higher now than they ever were. Because with all this talk about evidence-based medicine, it's more reimbursement-driven. The cartoon says, the doctor says, well, I can operate or you can go on a strict diet. And the patient says, well, you better operate because my insurance doesn't cover a strict diet. And that's been the problem. And so what I term reimbursement-based medicine, not because doctors are only interested in money. Almost every doctor I know is genuinely interested in helping their patients. But if you're trained to use drugs and surgery and you're reimbursed to use drugs and surgery, then use drugs and surgery. You know, it's like Maslow said, if the only tool you have is a hammer, you tend to see everything as a nail. But we can do better. And that's when I realized that we could do 1,000 studies with 1,000,000 patients, and this would always remain on the fringes of medical practice, that it wasn't enough to have good science. We also had to change reimbursement. And I'll come back to that in a moment. Now, that's the health crisis. Let's talk about, you know, the energy crisis and the global warming crisis. It turns out that many people are also surprised to learn that more global warming is caused by eating meat and livestock consumption than all forms of transportation combined. So if you're driving a Prius to the drive-thru window at McDonald's, you may not necessarily be helping the environment all that much. It also takes 10 times more energy to eat higher on the food chain than if you eat more of a plant-based diet. And it's also a major cause of rainforest deforestation. And this is becoming much more mainstream. I've been working with former President Clinton since 1993. And then last week he was interviewed on Wolf Blitzer and talked publicly that he's now eating a near-vegan diet, you know, in part because Chelsea told him that he had to lose over 20 pounds to walk her down the aisle, and so he figured, well, maybe I'll go on a diet that's going to help my heart as well as my waist. And so he lost 26 pounds. But also he's talked about publicly about how he has more energy, he feels better, he's down to the weight of what he weighed in high school. And that's what we often find, is that people lose weight and they feel better, and that's ultimately what makes us sustainable. But again, what's good for you is good for the planet, and it's also good for other countries. There is this what I call globalization of chronic disease that's going on as other countries are starting to eat like us and live like us and die like us. And it's all happened in the last 20 years. If you've been to China or Japan or India lately, you know, diabetes is epidemic there. Heart disease is epidemic. And it's even in developing countries like Africa. It's in many countries, more people are dying today of heart and blood vessel diseases and diabetes and AIDS and tuberculosis and malaria combined. And so what's happening is it's diverting a lot of precious resources from things that really do require drug treatment, like AIDS, TB, and malaria, to things that don't, like diabetes and heart disease. And what's really perverse is that people are flying to India to get their bypasses cheaper. You know, they're copying our way of treating disease as well as copying our ways of causing disease. And yet it would be so much smarter if we could just go back to, you know, the indigenous ways of eating that cause these things to occur to be prevented in the first place. So as I mentioned, I realized that we needed to not just show that these approaches are medically effective, but also cost effective. So we did a series of 3 demonstration projects with more than 6,000 patients. And we consistently showed that we were able to motivate people to make and maintain bigger changes in their diet and lifestyle, achieve better clinical outcomes and even larger cost savings than had been shown before. The first one was done with Mutual of Omaha, and we said, let's offer people a lifestyle program as a direct alternative to having a bypass or angioplasty and give people a choice. And they found that almost 80% of the people were able to avoid bypass surgery or angioplasty that they otherwise would have received, and they found they saved almost $30,000 per patient in the first year. That's a lot. We did a second study with Highmark Blue Cross Blue Shield, who was one of the companies covering our program, and they had such good success, they decided to actually provide it in several sites. They found, doing a match control group with their head of medical informatics, who was highly skeptical to the point of being a little bit hostile to this whole idea, and he found that after the first year, their costs were cut in half, and there was an additional 20 to 30% reduction in costs, again, in the years 2 and 3. Again, because these mechanisms are so dynamic, not only do you feel better very quickly, but you can show cost savings in the first year. That's important, by the way, because until recently, when health reform, a third of people change insurance companies every year, and so insurance companies would say, well, why should I pay for this? Because chances are there someone else is going to get the benefits, some other insurance company. And we said, no, you can actually show the benefits in the first year. And by the way, just to digress, with the health reform, Senator Harkin and I got in these public debates with the head of the Congressional Budget Office at the time, and they'd say, well, we can't pay for lifestyle, that's prevention, and prevention is going to make people live longer, and so that's going to cost more money. Like, that's a bad thing, you know. And then the best news is that after 16 years, Medicare is now covering our program. It took 16 years, even though we had the support of Bill Clinton when he was president, Newt Gingrich when he was Speaker of the House. Again, this transcends those kind of party differences. And I remember 10 or 11 years ago when I was talking with the head of Medicare at the time, who weighed almost 300 pounds and chain smoked, and he said, well, Dean, we'll do a demonstration project, but first you have to get a letter from the head of the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute of the National Institutes of Health saying that your program is safe. And I said, safe? You mean like as an alternative to having your chest cut open? He said, no, that it's just safe for older people to walk, meditate, eat vegetables, and quit smoking. And I said, you must be joking. And he wasn't. And that's what we had to do. And so the Claude Lanfant, the head, and Larry Freeman, the heads of the NHLBI, we consulted. They got a letter. He sent a letter. You know what? The diet is safe. Don't worry. It's okay. And then a month goes by, and he sends another letter. Well, you said the diet is safe, but you still haven't said, is it safe for older people to walk and meditate and quit smoking? We had to do a second literature review. I mean, it's at that level, really. You can't make this stuff up. But now they're paying for it. If Medicare pays for it, then everyone will pay for it. And then it really does become a standard of care. And it affects not only medical practice, but even medical education. I just want to show you the data on the first almost 2,000 patients. We've now replicated this in almost 6,000 patients. And we published the second 3,000 patients in the American Journal of Health Promotion earlier this year in 24 different hospital sites. And we've trained hospitals now in 48 different sites in not only academic centers like at UCSF and Scripps and Harvard and so on, but also in Omaha and Des Moines and Columbia, South Carolina, where they told me gravy's a beverage, this will be a big change in our lifestyle, which it was. And just to show you, we showed beginning, 12 weeks, 1 year, I'm just going to kind of flash through these, almost a 20-pound weight loss, the chest pain fell dramatically, the ability to exercise increased and stayed up, the quality of life improved dramatically and stayed up, the systolic blood pressure went down, the diastolic blood pressure went down. For many people, again, this is to the range where they can get off these medications that they were told that they have to take forever. Their diabetics got to a normal blood sugar to the point where they could get off their diabetes medications, in most cases under their doctor's care, and therefore prevent the ravages of diabetes. And so it's not just prevention. It can be, but it can also be treatment, which is important. And again, the more people changed, the more they improved, and the better they felt. And the better they felt, the more sustainable it became. And so I wrote a book called The Spectrum to get away from this idea. The most common criticism I get is that, yeah, it works, but it's too hard and nobody will do it and it's too extreme. And if you're trying to reverse heart disease or prostate cancer, it is kind of extreme because that's what it takes to reverse it. That's why no one showed it before, is they didn't go far enough scientifically. But I don't think it's as extreme as getting your chest cut open or having your prostate removed and being impotent the rest of your life. I mean, that's kind of extreme to me. I mean, the whole thing seems a little bit topsy-turvy. It's like, wait a minute, you're paying $100 billion to treat heart disease with bypass surgery and angioplasty. And by the way, bypass surgery has not been shown to prolong life either in stable patients, except for the 1 or 2% who have the most severe disease that have what's called left main disease and poor left ventricular function. The other 98% of people, it doesn't. So we pay for things that are dangerous, invasive, expensive, and largely ineffective, $100 billion, And that's conservative. That's the conservative treatment. But, you know, walking, meditating, eating vegetables, and quit smoking, that's radical. But even so, you have a spectrum of choices. What matters most is your overall way of eating and living. And so it's the ounce of prevention and the pound of cure. If you just want to lose a few pounds or get your cholesterol down or your weight or just feel better, you know, start by making moderate changes. And if that's enough to accomplish your goal, great, you're there. And if not, it doesn't mean you failed diet or whatever. Just do more. Because, again, there is a spectrum of how efficiently your body can metabolize fat and cholesterol. There's a spectrum on all these different things. And so there's no way to predict precisely how much you need to change. We're developing a digital platform now that we'll be introducing in the next few months to make it really fun and easy to do this. And when I chaired Google's Health Advisory Board for a couple of years, and the idea was, let's come up with a really complex set of algorithms where you say, I want to lower my cholesterol 50 points or get my blood pressure down 10 points or whatever it is, and then we'll plug in your genetic information, and then we'll tell you exactly, here's how much you have to change in order to do that. And then one day I thought, you know, you're just going about this in entirely the wrong way. Because if you're trying to, do a research study, you need to ask all these three-day diet diaries and food frequency questionnaires and health risk assessments and all that. You need to know exactly what people are eating and doing. But if we're just trying to inspire people to change their lifestyle, it's just directional. You know, it's like instead of saying, if you row crew, it's 300 calories an hour, and if you do archery, it's 30 calories an hour. It's like, what's the best exercise? It's the one you enjoy. You know, if you like it, you'll do it. So just do more. You know, it's just radically simplified. Instead of making it so complex, make it so simple and get rid of the friction. We don't have to have all these questionnaires and just make it fun and interesting. And so instead of saying these are good foods and bad foods, because again, once you say foods are bad, then you're a bad person. That doesn't work. Say foods aren't good or bad. Some foods are healthier for you than others. So I just categorize foods from the most helpful, what I call group one, to the least helpful, group five, and groups two through four, intermediate. And again, what matters most is your overall way of eating and living. If you're trying to reverse a chronic disease, you'd be better off eating mostly the healthiest foods. But otherwise, if you indulge yourself one day, eat healthier the next. If you don't exercise one day, do a little more the next. You get the idea. And then it becomes sustainable because it's not all or nothing. And so it's a very compassionate approach because it turns out the most toxic emotions are fear, anger, humiliation, and shame and guilt, right? And that's what you feel when you go on almost any diet and lifestyle program because nobody's perfect. And sooner or later, you can feel it in two ways. One is sooner or later, you're not doing everything you're supposed to be doing. And so you feel, oh, God, I don't want to do it. I'm just done. Or you're not logging all the things the way you're supposed to do it. You know, I still get these emails from one of the online programs that says, Dr. Ornish, you have successfully completed 0% of your food logging this week. It's like it might as well go, you jerk, you know. And that's not sustainable. So what we did is we say, look, you can enter it as much or as little as you want. The more you enter it, the more frequently you do it, the more accurate it's going to be. But again, it doesn't have to be that accurate. It's just directional. And so if you don't log your food for a day or for a week, just enter it when you feel like it. And that's enough. So you can't fail. You can't fail because there's no diet to get on, so there's no diet to get off. There's no exercise program to get off. And you can't fail in terms of how you log your food. And so it's a very compassionate approach. Now, again, the more you change, the more better you feel and the more you improve. That's really the bottom line. And it's not all or nothing. The last thing I want to talk about is, to me, I think perhaps the most important, which is the real epidemic isn't just heart disease or obesity. It's loneliness and depression and isolation. And if you say, what is the most commonly prescribed prescription drugs the last few years? It's been the antidepressants, because there are a lot of depressed people out there. That was my doorway. I was profoundly depressed to the point of being suicidal when I was in college. That's how I got interested in this. I've written about this in a couple of my books, in the Reversing Heart Disease book and in the Love and Survival book. But, you know, change is hard. But if you're in enough pain and somebody can show you how you can use that pain as a catalyst for transforming our lives, then the pain itself can become a teacher. I can't tell you how many patients have said to me, having a heart attack was the best thing that ever happened to me, or having the diagnosis of prostate cancer was a good thing. And without in any way minimizing or trivializing it, I'd say, what are you, nuts? And they'd say, no. That's what it took to get my attention to begin making these changes that have made my life so much more joyful and meaningful, I probably wouldn't have gotten interested in all this weird stuff otherwise. Now, hopefully, we don't have to wait for that. But still, if we can meet people when they're suffering, the suffering itself can be a powerful catalyst. And here again, awareness is the first step in healing. And if we understand that the people who are lonely and isolated and depressed, not only does it affect the quality of our lives, it affects the quantity of our lives, our survival. And to a much larger degree than we had once realized. study after study has shown that people who are lonely and depressed are 3 to 10 times more likely to get sick and die prematurely than those who have a sense of love and connection and community. Now, in part because you're more likely to abuse yourself when you're feeling lonely and depressed. I'd ask people in our studies, you know, why do you smoke and overeat and drink too much and play too many video games? You know, these things seem so maladaptive to me. And they'd say, you don't get it. You don't have a clue, Dean. These behaviors are very adaptive because they help us get through the day. One woman said, I've got 20 friends in this pack of cigarettes, and they're always there for me, and nobody else is. You're going to take away my 20 friends? What are you going to give me? Or they say, food fills the void. Or a well-known food writer said, you know, when I get depressed, I eat a lot of fat. It coats my nerves and numbs the pain. Or alcohol numbs the pain. Or other drugs numb the pain. Or working all the time numbs the pain. Or video games numb the pain. We have lots of ways of numbing and killing and bypassing literally or figuratively the pain. But the pain isn't the problem. The pain is the messenger. The pain says, hey, listen up. Pay attention. You're not doing something that's in your best interest. And if we just kill or numb or bypass the pain without listening to it, it's like, you know, you clip the wires to a fire alarm and you go back to sleep, you know, while your house just keeps burning. The fire just gets bigger. You just kill the messenger. And so what we do in our work is we don't just focus on the behaviors. We don't just give people information. I mean, if information were enough to change behavior, nobody would smoke. It's not like people don't know it's bad for you. You have to work at a deeper level. And I want to just show you a couple of studies that talk about that. At Yale, they studied men and women who were about to have an angiogram to see how much blockage they had in their arteries. And they found that the more loved and support they felt reported by feeling from their spouse or lover, the less blockage they had in their arteries, independent of their blood pressure, their cholesterol, or any other traditional risk factors. When you're depressed, your immune system is depressed. Studies have shown that all the markers of immune function are impaired when you're lonely and depressed. Margaret Chesney, who's now running the Osher Center here at UCSF, found that patients who were HIV positive that were also depressed had more than double the likelihood of developing AIDS and dying than those who weren't. So again, these things affect our survival. And David Spiegel did a wonderful study at Stanford where he took women with metastatic breast cancer who were getting the usual chemo and radiation and surgery, but in addition, he randomly assigned half of them to a group that also met together once a week in a loving, supportive environment where they were encouraged to let down their emotional defenses and talk authentically about what it's like, what their life is like, and to be seen and heard and felt, and not given some glib advice on how to fix it, but just to be present with that. He just did that for a year thinking, well, this will help the quality of their lives, and it did, but 5 years later, he found that those patients who had the support group lived twice as long compared to those who didn't, 36 months versus 18 months. Now, later studies had a harder time replicating that, and then when they found that the women who were estrogen receptor positive didn't show that same benefit because the treatment of estrogen receptor positive breast cancer had become so much more advanced that it kind of overrode the effect on the breast cancer, but the estrogen receptor negative still was able to see that. And it just shows you how powerful these things are. So anything that promotes intimacy is healing. And these are very old ideas. The word yoga comes from the Sanskrit to yoke, to unite, to bring together. The word health comes from the root to make whole. These are very old ideas. And so the same spiritual themes that you find in virtually all spiritual and religious traditions are altruism, forgiveness, compassion, and love. And that's what frees us from our suffering right here and right now. And the last story I want to share with you is that on my very first day of my first study in 1977, when I was a second-year medical student, I had a group of men and women in a hotel for a month. And on the first day, the 75-year-old dentist who hated gay men started yelling at one of the other men, who was, of course, gay, and they got at it. They both got so angry. One got severe chest pain and took a Nitro. The other got severe chest pain and took a Demerol. And I thought, this is going to be the end of my very short research career. They're all both going to have heart attacks and die. And so I started talking to this son. You know, you're giving the power to give yourself chest pain or even a heart attack to the guy that you hate the most. That's not very smart. And so, again, forgiveness doesn't excuse or condone what the other person did, but it frees us from the suffering that it causes. And so it's liberating in that way. And so for me, the last slide I want to show you is that what I'm most interested in doing this work is not just unclogging arteries and so on. It's important. But, you know, the ancient swamis and rabbis and priests and monks and nuns didn't discover these techniques to unclog their arteries or get their blood pressure down or reverse their prostate cancer. It can do all those things. But they're powerful tools for transforming our lives, for quieting down our minds and bodies so we can experience more of an inner sense of peace and joy and well-being. And when we work on that level, we find that we can really become healers for each other and not just technicians. And so thank you so very much for the chance to be here today. I'm very grateful.
A reminder for our radio audience, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our speaker today is Dr. Dean Ornish, president and founder of the Preventative Medicine Research Institute. We have time just for a few questions.
And if there are other questions, I'm happy to stay during the book signing and answer them individually.
Let me tell you, there's a big stack of questions right here. First off, you mentioned fish oil. What are your thoughts about vitamin D supplementation and calcium supplementation?
I also recommend vitamin D3 supplementation. That's one of the few other supplements that's consistently been shown to be beneficial. And calcium supplementation may or may not be beneficial. It turns out that most people with osteoporosis, the issue is not a deficiency of calcium intake, but too much excretion of calcium. And when you eat a diet that's high in animal protein, it causes your body to excrete more calcium. And so I tend to focus more on that area.
Salt.
Well, you know, salt is mainly a problem because it causes your body to retain fluid. And when you retain fluid in a closed system, your blood pressure goes up. So if you don't have a problem with high blood pressure or heart failure or things like that, a little salt may go a long way towards eating healthier food. But salt, even though it's one of your four basic tastes, is an acquired taste. And so as you begin to reduce the amount of salt in your diet, you actually find you begin to prefer foods that are lower in salt. The natural flavor of the food comes out more. And then you go out to dinner and suddenly the food tastes too salty. So you can modify that slowly. And I was consulting with McDonald's to get them to make healthier foods, and we agreed to have them reduce the amount of salt in their foods and also to take the trans fats out of their french fries and to put the salads in that you see. But they didn't want to tell anybody that they were reducing the salt in their french fries because they were afraid that people would think they didn't taste right, but they just did it quietly, and then nobody even noticed.
I'm going to roll two questions together now. What is your opinion of eating processed soy products, meat alternatives, tofu, and I've recently been advised to stop drinking, taking soy on the basis that I don't need increased estrogen?
Well, the reason why soy is actually beneficial is because it provides the phytoestrogens, and the phytoestrogens look enough like estrogen that they'll bind to the estrogen receptor, but they keep the regular estrogen from binding. It's like a key that'll fit in a lock, but it won't open it, but it keeps the regular key from fitting in there. And estrogen tends to cause cell growth and proliferation, which unchecked may cause breast and prostate cancer. So moderate soy consumption is actually beneficial in reducing your risk of cancer. But too much soy, particularly if you take it in the form of supplements where you get really concentrated soy, I think is to be avoided.
Unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where there's time for only one last question, and this is one topic that I don't think you touched on. Menopause, hot flashes, hormones, vision changes, help.
Well, here again, the phytoestrogens can be helpful for that in the soy products and such, because they can help give you just enough of the estrogen to reduce the symptoms without too much that can cause problems. And also the meditation and other things like that can make a big difference. So again, thank you so much for the chance to be here. I'm happy to stay as long as you want after the book signing to answer any questions that you have, whether or not you get a book. And most of all, thank you for the chance to be of service here today. I appreciate it.
Our thanks to Dr. Dean Ornish, president and founder of the Preventative Medicine Research Institute. We also thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and the Internet. This program has been held in association with the Commonwealth Club's Health and Medicine Forum. I'm Dr. Kim Mulvihill, and now the meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.